Right, have a busy day of Cabinet and Committee today. We're starting with, we approve for introduction, the Income Tax Bill. This is the second stage of a major rewrite and update of the Income Tax Act. The first stage was passed in 2004, and this, I'm told, completes a 15-year process of revision and modernisation and updating the Act. We've agreed to the tabling of the Government response to the Regulations Review Committee on its investigation into deemed regulations which are not presented to Parliament. Agreed to the tariff order going to Executive Council, which brings the free trade agreement with Chile into effect from the 8th of November. That's Wednesday next week. That's when the agreement takes effect in Chile. Agreed to the release of a discussion paper on flexible working arrangements and how to increase their availability and take-up. This responds to a request from the Select Committee, which has been looking at the Members' Bill, which is in front of Parliament at the moment, on flexible working hours. And that discussion paper will be out for discussion in November and December from the Department of Labour. Agreed to draw up regulations to implement a national environmental standard for sources of drinking water, following feedback on the consultation paper which was released last year. We've also finalised the names of those who will be conducting the inquiry into local government rates, and Mark Burton should have an announcement on that in the course of the week. Agreed to the release of a discussion paper going out on a strategy for biosecurity, science, research and technology for New Zealand. That's coming from Jim Anderton. Also agreed to release from Ministry of Research, Science and Technology what they are calling roadmaps, which chart the way ahead for science across biotechnology, nanotechnology, the environment and energy. Roadmaps give signals to the funding and investment agencies and to research providers about what the government's expectations and needs are in those areas. That's Steve Mahari's area. We're going to another round of targeted consultation on the Commissioning Rule, Contracts and the Copyright Act 1994. This is a review Judith Tizard has been overseeing and following the first round of consultation and submissions and consideration, we're going to another targeted round with a view to making policy decisions somewhere towards the end of the first quarter next year. And we've also agreed to the release of the proposals for consultation on improving energy efficiency in our buildings, which of course helps reduce energy demand and greenhouse gas emissions, as well as people keeping people's homes warmer. Clayton Cosgrove will be releasing that. Otherwise, coming up this week, I see Ruth Dyson has already issued a document on public consultation around reverse mortgages packages. That's something we announced we'd be getting Office of Senior Citizens to work on, so that when older people, for example, looking to release equity in their homes, they do so and are able to see that the schemes they're doing it with actually meet a proper standard. So we're trying to get to some standards in that area. The Property Law Bill will be tabled today. Tomorrow, the royal visit of the Crown Prince of the Netherlands commences. It goes through till the end of the week. There will be two quite important business-related summits this week. The first starting tomorrow is the one which Steve Mahari and Ministry of Research, Science and Technology have organised around capitalising on our research, commercialising our innovation. The conference is oversubscribed. It's proven to be very popular. And also on Wednesday, Michael Cullen has been working with Business Council for Sustainable Development on a kind of pre-budget summit, if you like. So there'll be quite a gathering of business people here for that. Tuesday, Trevor Mallard expects to put out the changes proposed to the regimes which govern access to transport corridors, and Leanne Dalziel should be in a position to release her first milestone report on the major review of regulation which she and Commerce are undertaking. Wednesday should also see an evaluation of the Beachheads program. Well, that's the offshore incubator program which has been spread through the states, Middle East, Singapore, UK, to help Kiwi businesses that need to get to market quickly, but are of a relatively small size, and get established in new markets through the NZTE established Beachhead. And come Thursday, I understand Damien O'Connor will have something to say about the decisions we've made on the pictorial health warnings on cigarette packets, which I'm told are truly gruesome, as they should be. Right, any questions?
What concerns were raised for you and the student for that of Britain on climate change? Anything particularly related to New Zealand that you were concerned about?
I've yet to see the report or official advice on it, but I have been following the articles coming through the British press, particularly The Observer, yesterday, and noting that very senior government MPs, prominent ex-ministers in Britain, are putting their names to a range of ideas about climate change-related initiatives for the future. Obviously, what has been foreshadowed from the Stern report, which is a report officially commissioned by the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, is that Sir Nicholas Stern sees economic and environmental catastrophe coming from no serious effort to address climate change. I'm told that this report is seen as particularly significant because generally reports around climate change have come from those coming at it very much from a scientific evidence point of view. He is coming at it from the point of view of what are the economic consequences. So it adds a new layer of information and understanding, if you like, around the problem. Now, what was coming through in the quality British press yesterday was something that's concerned me for several years, that the next round of protectionism New Zealand will face will be in environmental barriers and tariffs to our trade, which may take off, even though ill-founded. For example, the concept of food miles. Now, our advice is that the carbon emissions from New Zealand's dairy industry and shipping produce around the world to Europe are rather less than total of the carbon emissions from producing the same products in Europe itself. So we will, of course, prepare to go to battle on the facts rather than on emotion around us. Another point that came from the British press at the weekend highlights the particular threat of some measures which could be taken in Europe affecting our fruit, vegetable and flour export trade. For example, there was talk of global warming premiums against exotic fruits, vegetable flours flowing from around the world, and there was a specific mention of New Zealand kiwi fruit, 1 kilogram air freighted, leading to 5 kilograms of carbon emissions. Leave aside the fact that kiwi fruit isn't generally air freighted anyway. Now, you know, we are very distant from high value markets. We have to get it there somewhere. And I think that reinforces the point I was making on Saturday, that New Zealand really needs to redouble its efforts on sustainability to be offsetting, at the very least, a lot of the arguments about us as a carbon emitter, even in just getting goods to market. So we really do have to take these issues extremely seriously and be mindful of our reputation as an economy.
In Britain, though, there's a lot of discussion that the levers they're going to apply to reduce carbon emissions mostly seem to be tax-based levers. Is that a reality that we'll face in New Zealand?
In Britain, they haven't had a minority government for many years. And, of course, you govern by consent, you govern by majorities which you can mobilise around legislation. The truth is that the limited carbon charge that we had planned did not enjoy the parliamentary majority after the last election. And that was one of the issues, along with the radically changed advice on what New Zealand's net position was in the first commitment period of Kyoto, which sent us back to the drawing boards on a bigger, better, more comprehensive strategy. Now, these strategies are always bound to have sticks and carrots, but we need to take, obviously, a majority of Parliament with us if there are to be sticks. Everyone will vote for carrots, but there need to be some balance of incentives and disincentives around some of these issues.
Well, you mentioned that during the weekend at the conference. So what do you mean by sticks?
Well, it's the sort of issues that would be canvassed, for example, in the proposals in the discussion paper, or the range of options to consider in the discussion paper that's coming on sustainable land use and management before Christmas. And that's covering the issues around forestry and around agricultural land use. Again, you could look at the transport area and decisions which could be taken around the age at which cars can be imported from offshore. So across all these kinds of areas, looking at energy generation, the transport fleet, fuel emissions, afforestation, land use and agriculture, there's going to need to be a comprehensive package.
Can I just ask you just briefly, this is something that's been put to the Environmental Secretary in the UK, that they're trying to say, for example, get the average consumer to use their motor vehicle less, and it seems that the consumer's car in the UK is going to suffer, the same mixture of £1,000 a year in cost based on fuel-based costs or taxes, parking taxes, road tolling taxes, to shift people from car usage to public transport or whatever other means. So, surely that must be something that's on this government's programme or something this government's considering as well?
Well, that hasn't cropped up to the best of my recollection, the options we've been looking at. And it's fair to say, of course, that up until the past year, the Ministry of Transport hasn't really been particularly engaged in these issues, so we're starting policy development there from a reasonably low base. The reality is that the high price of fuel in New Zealand over particularly the last year and a half or so has already affected quite a significant change in people's transport behaviour and patterns. And public transport usage has taken off. You'll be aware of the reports in Wellington about having to stand all the way in on the train. Trains in Auckland, the usage is soaring. Bus usage is soaring. And we are now running to catch up with the demand for public transport. Now, service is a very, very positive problem to have because it not only eases congestion in your city, but is also going to make a contribution to the greenhouse gas reduction program. So those are the sort of issues we've been looking at. The reality is that the volatility upwards in the price of fuel probably put a much greater burden on the consumer's purse than the very limited carbon charge ever would have.
This campaign's moving quite quickly, though. Do you still detect that your support partners are resistant to tax or price-based measures to encourage fuel efficiency and so on?
I think the debate is moving really fast, and when I wrote and drafted the speech and thought about what I would say about sustainability, I really didn't have it in my mind that Sir Nicholas Stern was about to issue a major report. But I do follow the debate generally offshore, and one can see that sustainability issues are really a huge focus of debate in the Western Social Democratic parties and indeed in governments more generally. Now, when push comes to shove and when more is known in New Zealand about the size and scale of the problem, it may well be that people say, yes, we do need a balanced package of measures between sticks and carrots. I've had communications today from Business Council for Sustainable Development. Their press statement talked about some of their research and the level of awareness among New Zealanders of the size of the problem. So I think it's all promising in terms of the climate change issue no longer being remote, abstract, theoretical. People are starting to see that this is real and it's got implications for us.
Do you think we need to have a stern equivalent look at the economic impact on New Zealand, or do you take his view as being a global one that applies to us?
Well, I think that's an interesting thought. We should look at his report, which, from what we're seeing foreshadowed, seems to be pitched at the international impact, and then look at whether we need to commission anything specifically here which would look at the economic consequences for us. I think we're broadly aware of what rising sea levels and much more volatile climate would do to our agricultural-based economy, but it may need be that we need to be taking a rather broader look than that.
Can you clarify the carbon neutral thing? Do you see yourself at some point actually stating that as an absolute goal, or is it just one of those kind of aspirational things you say at the party conference?
Well, the purpose of the speech at the party conference was to set out a direction and aspirations, and that got a very warm response. I detect a lot of enthusiasm within officialdom for upping the level of work in this area. We have been doing an evaluation of how that first Sustainable Development Plan of Action went from 2003 through to 2006, and where we take the Sustainable Development Action Plan from there. So I think I would be looking to my Prime Minister's statement next February to indicate more direction and policy substance around these issues, and we'll continue to build on that.
Because the carbon neutral is a giant leap even beyond the Kyoto commitment, isn't it? It's not just curbing growth, it's bringing us back to neutrality. And putting that in the context of the problems you have with the so-called climate tax and the carbon tax, every time you try to put a price on it, you seem to run into lobby groups and vested interests who don't want to pay it, and you get public opposition. I mean, aren't you buying a big fight here?
Well, I don't think so. I think that the concept of being carbon neutral is one that clearly involves offsetting behaviour which is carbon emitting with phenomena which isn't. And for example, when the Honourable David Parker went to the major climate change conference in Montreal at the end of last year, the Canadian government asked all participating governments if they would offset the carbon emissions caused by the air travel for the conference with tree planting, which we agreed to do. Now, there's a lot of that going on around the world. People saying, well, there's going to be a certain amount of carbon emission, but how could we compensate through that for that through forest sink initiatives or other kinds of initiatives? So it's about how you offset what is, in some cases might be inevitable for some time to come. Now, in the issue of coal, for example, which excited a certain amount of attention yesterday flowing from Premier Peter Beattie's comments, there's quite a debate going on internationally about how carbon capture and sequestration should be treated, because under the London Convention on the Prevention of Marine Pollution by Dumping of Waste, if you were to define carbon sequestration below seabed as dumping the waste, it's a problem. So there's a debate going on about is there a way to do this without causing environmental problems. But some of the advice I've had suggests that by mid-century, 20 to 40% of the carbon in fossil fuel emissions could technically be capable of capture. Now that's quite a significant amount, and that could include the carbon dioxide emissions of 30 to 60%. Of your energy generation. So that's all interesting for us, having, as we do, a certain amount of thermal generation.
But carbon neutrality is not offsetting your growth from now, is it? It's taking us back, presumably, to an absolute carbon neutral position.
Well, as I say, that's aspirational. Mm.
Minister, you didn't have the parliamentary numbers for a carbon tax. Did you try to lobby the party on this?
We were advised that they were not supporting it.
We considered joining the AP6, Prime Minister, the AP6 countries, like China, I think, is one of them, Japan, yes. The US, as opposed to Kyoto.
That's right. Japan, Korea, US, Australia, China. Yes, we would be interested. At the moment, membership isn't open. David Parker made a speech about this probably 3-4 weeks ago and said that we would certainly be exploring whether a membership or association would be possible because those in it include Japan, which has ratified the Kyoto Protocol and takes it very seriously, as well as those who haven't ratified, and it includes the major emitters like China, and I think I may be right in saying India is in as the sixth partner as well. Now, for the second, for the post-first commitment period of Kyoto, there really needs to be some movement by the major emitters who aren't part of the first commitment period, and that is the Chinas, it is the Indias. So we have our minister going up to the conference in Nairobi within the next week or two to discuss precisely what should follow the first commitment period. And we will be putting forward the point of view that we're prepared to pull our weight, but we'd actually like to see all emitters pulling their weight.
At the beginning, you were talking about the concerns over environmental protectionism. And you talked about redoubling our effort on sustainability. I mean, are we really going to redouble our effort, or is the government just going to carry on the policy work it's doing? I mean, from a point of view of the consumer, what's the tangible outcome? Where do we see the redoubling?
Well, there's been a huge amount of thinking, rethinking, policy development flowing from the need to deal with the climate change issue. And I think sustainability actually goes rather broader than that as well. As I say, I'll be looking to have officials, as they advise us on what we achieve from our first Sustainable Development Programme of Action, to be looking at where we now go overall with sustainability. And I'll be looking to put some more flesh on that bone, some more thinking around that, into the Prime Minister's statement I give in February.
Do you see that there needs to be a lot more investment in public transport to address this issue?
Sure, it's going to have to be growing, ongoing.
Is it going to come from central government?
Well, usually it does. But look, we've hugely increased spending on public transport, but clearly there is a need for more. When you see the pressure on the system and Wellington and Auckland in particular, when you see the impact that the increased fuel prices have had on the private motor car use, there's going to have to be more.
Prime Minister, how do you square these aspirations with the biofuels target of 1/4% rising eventually to 2.25%? I mean, that's not really going to transform.
May have to improve quite substantially.
Prime Minister, are you concerned that if New Zealand ends up having to fight new trade barriers, you were talking about just air miles and fruit and vegetables, that we could be branded in a way that we don't want to be, and actually that is as anti, you know,
global? That's my point. Unless we're being seen to go the extra mile in sustainability, we run the risk of being labelled as simply unsustainable producers, major carbon emitters, even trying to get our produce to market. Now, I think the leadership of our primary sectors like dairy are very, very aware of these issues. I believe it's why industries like dairy have readily entered into agreements like the one on clean stream accords and so on. They are very conscious of the wealthy market's interest in the food they consume being clean and green and sustainable in the way it's produced, and so the whole industry being clean and green.
So what do you make of Federated Farmers, Mr. Peterson's view? Seems to be directly opposed.
Well, yes, it does, but I think if you look to industry leaders across your dairy industry, you meet other areas, Zespri, you'll find people very, very conscious of these bigger issues in getting goods to market.
Australia's raised concern that its troops in East Timor have been targeted by some sort of conservative campaign against them, and that youth rage there has been stirred up with alcohol and methamphetamine. And I'm wondering whether we will be reviewing the security for our personnel there, or whether there's any wider concern.
No, I haven't heard a report on that. Obviously, the violence of the last few days is very disturbing. What I am told is that the security force there from offshore is absolutely essential to maintaining any kind of law and order, and I don't think the case for it is going to go away anytime soon, unfortunately.
The Australian military has indicated that some of these disturbances may have been politically motivated. Have you been briefed on that at all?
No, I haven't. I am aware that the inquiry into what happened was rather critical of the political factor behind the serious riots and disturbances and killings of a few months ago, but I haven't followed it that closely in the last few days.
Can I ask you if you are at all concerned about the management practices of Air New Zealand and what you can do to stop their trend of outsourcing and cutting wages?
Well, obviously I've just been at the Labor Party conference where unions are represented, which are in the process of discussion with Air New Zealand about the latest proposals with respect to contracting out of check-in and related staff. My advice has been to the unions to fully engage in the processes they have under their collective agreements. And there are quite elaborate processes which, when the company triggers them by putting up a substantial proposal, as a proposal to remove 1,300 full-time equivalent staff on the payroll is, then the union has the chance to respond, and there's quite detailed timelines around that. My understanding is that the airline advised the unions that its preference was to keep the work in-house, so that's a positive beginning. As with the earlier proposals which the engineers and one other union dealt with around the engineering workshops in Christchurch and Auckland, I understand the unions have hired expert advice to look at the Air New Zealand proposal, look at what Air New Zealand says its objectives are, and look at whether there are other ways of meeting that objectives or coming a significant way to meeting those objectives for cost control. So what I would say is that the process has to be a positive one. It's one of engagement, and given that the airline is understood to have expressed a view that it would prefer to keep the work in-house, that should encourage the unions to work hard at those negotiations.
Isn't it ironic that the government spends all that money saving an iconic national carrier only to see a matter of years later a lot of the work being shipped offshore?
Well, it wouldn't be shipped offshore because you can't check in people offshore. You've got to check them in at Auckland Airport counter and the rest of it. It's a question of who employs them. And my understanding is that the airline has expressed a preference for doing that in-house, and that should encourage the unions to go right through the consultation process.
But only if they can cut their wages by, you know, by savings of 20%, or they get employed by an overseas company.
Well, that's something that the union's going to have to work through with the company. Obviously, the company has to be mindful of cost. Full-service airlines like Air New Zealand have been under pressure in developed countries for years. Not all have survived. Belgium no longer has a national airline. Swiss Air hit the rocks big time. Look at the chapter whatever bankruptcies of major full-service US airlines. This is a tough industry to be in. Now, the truth is that since the government purchased the airline in its bleakest hours in late 2001, it's made a staggering recovery. It's actually done extremely well, but it's always going to have to look to costs. And if it can work in a way that's productive, and engages the unions in discussion about how it goes ahead, that's got to be a positive process.
Can the government, though, as the majority shareholder, exercise its view as to the moral direction that Air New Zealand takes, or do you really have to remain hands-off and treat it as any other commercial enterprise?
Well, of course, the difference between Air New Zealand and other companies in which the government is engaged is it's not an SOE. In fact, it hasn't been an SOE since the late 80s. With SOEs, there are very clear paths for setting out shareholder expectations, but Air New Zealand is a listed company on the stock exchange. So the government has always been very proper about what its role is vis-a-vis Air New Zealand. We appoint directors, they appoint management, but you know, clearly as a government we have expectations which I've just expressed about working through collective agreement procedures, which to be fair to Air New Zealand, they did do in a good spirit over the engineers' proposals, and I think with as good an outcome as you could have hoped for.
The Greens have raised concern today about some of the investments by the New Zealand Super Fund in companies that mine uranium. Is that a concern to you that there might be some benefits there for the fund from the nuclear industry?
Well, I haven't got any brief on that. I saw as I rushed out of the office a comment from Michael Callan's office that said that he didn't at this time have grounds to be concerned, but I really haven't looked at any further than that.
Did the remit at the Labor Party conference on state funding and other issues surrounding it reflect the government's thinking?
I didn't follow either the remit or the decision on it, so... Yeah.